Today's podcast is brought to you by Newspapers.com, your portal to the past. If you're like me and can't get enough of untold stories and forgotten tales, you're in for a treat. Newspapers.com has nearly a billion pages of historical newspapers dating back to the 1690s, and you can search them all in seconds. It's a treasure trove waiting for curious minds like yours. And with papers from across the US, UK, Canada, Australia, and beyond, Newspapers.com is the ultimate resource to unearth the stories that shaped our world. And here's something special for our history-loving listeners. Newspapers.com is offering an exclusive discount. Use the code HISTORYUNPLUGGED and get 20% off your subscription. That's promo code HISTORYUNPLUGGED, one word, at Newspapers.com. It's like having your own time machine to explore the stories that made history come alive. One more time, HISTORYUNPLUGGED, promo code at Newspapers.com.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The fourth and final year of the Civil War was one of the most important and destructive times in all of American history. Ulysses S. Grant took command of all Union armies in March 1864, and 180,000 black soldiers joined the Union Army. In this time period, the South faced almost total destruction with William Tecumseh Sherman's March to the Sea, while at the same time, guerrilla war rages in Missouri, all leading up to the surrender at Appomattox Courthouse and the murder of Abraham Lincoln. Today I'm speaking with Sam Gwynn, author of the book Hymns of the Republic, the story of the final year of the American Civil War. There's lots of fresh angles about the war. For example, Robert E. Lee, known as a great general and Southern hero, dealt with frustration, failure, and loss. Ulysses S. Grant, known for his prowess on the battlefield, largely failed in the war, despite winning. His most amazing accomplishments began the moment he stopped fighting. William Tecumseh Sherman was a lousy general, but probably the single most brilliant man in the war, leading to its end. And one of the most important factors of the war was the role of black Union soldiers, many of them former slaves. And interestingly enough, the Confederacy's plan to emancipate its own slaves and form all black units, which it did, even though these units didn't have much of an effect on the war. In this discussion, we get into some interesting tangents. For example, if Stonewall Jackson hadn't been killed, could the South have potentially won the Civil War, or at least not surrendered, and ended it on its own terms? And also, when does total war work? Sherman's March to the Sea resulted in the wholesale burning of huge parts of the South, and it helped the North win. But when does total war not work? In the examples of Afghanistan, when the Soviets occupied it, or the American War in Vietnam. So we get into the weeds a little bit with our Civil War discussion, but overall, there's some really interesting insights at the end of the war. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Sam Gwynn. Samuel, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's good to be talking to you.
All right. Well, I have a lot I'm excited to go over with you. First of all, let's begin with a basic point. So the title of your book is Hymns of the Republic. What does that refer to?
Well, it's the direct reference, I guess, would be to Battle Hymn of the Republic, the one that we all know. But that's a single thing. That's a unitary thing. It's a Union song, kind of a bloodthirsty Old Testament biblical Union song. And to me, there are so many other songs in the war. I mean, there's, if we're going to take, expressions By various people, and I don't mean literal. I mean metaphorical songs. I mean expressions of solidarity, whatever. You have whole groups that are not really represented necessarily by that song, including the entire Confederacy. So I thought, you know, the particularly the last year of the war, there are many constituencies, there are many voices here, and I guess that's what I was trying to suggest.
All right, and also I'm curious, because you focus on the last year of the Civil War, what is it that you're trying to contribute uniquely with this focus? Since the Civil War is well-trodden ground, although it has a lot of contemporary interest because many argue that our current issues stem from the aftermath of the Civil War. But what is it with the focus on the last year that you're trying to bring out?
Yes, well, to pick up on the last thing you said, yes, the war has never been more relevant, period. That's fact, and that's why you're hearing a lot about it now. So when I was, I really always loved the Civil War, and I'd written a biography of Stonewall Jackson, which is essentially about the first 2 years of the war, and I was trying to figure out what to do, and I kind of went back and looked at the original reason why I was interested in the Civil War, and that was a book by a wonderful historian named Bruce Catton, and it was called A Stillness at Appomattox, and it won the Pulitzer Prize in 1953. And it was really about the kind of the last year of the war as seen from the point of view of Grant's army, the Army of the Potomac. But I thought, well, okay, that must have been done about 30 times since then, you know, or 50 or 100, the last year of the war. But no one's really done it, not in a comprehensive way, or not nearly the way Catton did it. And my proposal was to do it. And I felt it was, and to finish the thought, I thought it was so meaningful because the war became so much more desperate, so much more bitter, so much more extreme. There were so many more radical things happening that were determinant of later things. For example, 180,000 black soldiers in the Union Army. At the very end, there were black soldiers in the Confederate Army, which people don't even know about. But there were definitive, you know, the guerrilla war in the end of in Missouri and Virginia and Kentucky, Tennessee, and other places. There was so much that I guess was definitive, so much that when the war ended became the definitive thinking about that. And I can keep going on here and I won't bore you, but that includes, you know, the politics and but anyway, so I it seemed like a really good lens through which to look at the war. And one again that I had was the original reason I got interested in the war. I thought, wow, this is really spectacular stuff. Sherman's March to the Sea and, you know, on and on and on. Great stuff.
I'll definitely have to circle back around to Confederate emancipation, which I think is one of the strangest aspects of the war. And I will also want to set things up with Grant and Lee. But before I do so, I need to veer off slightly on a tangent because you're a biographer of Stonewall Jackson. Listeners of the show may have heard a massive 20 plus episode series I did with a co-host on a military history of the Civil War. A question my co-host and I came back to often was it ever possible for the Confederacy to win the war? This Civil War buffs have argued this forever. On the yes column, they'd say, well, if they fought a war of attrition like the Revolutionary War, yes. Those in the nay column say that the fundamentals of industrialization in the North prevented it. But a key point that we came back to a lot was if Stonewall Jackson had not been killed, that would have added a lot of credibility to the yay column. So as a slight tangent, for you as a Stonewall Jackson biographer, had Stonewall Jackson not been killed, what do you think would have happened?
Oh, the Confederacy still loses. I mean, they can't possibly win that war. I mean, there's just no way. What they can do is they can force a negotiation. And early in the war, you talked about Britain or France or even Russia doing this. But, you know, what the Confederacy was trying to do, particularly in the last year of the war, was to make it so bloody awful, so just costly and bloody and miserable that the North would just come to terms. And of course, if Lincoln had lost that election in 1864, that very likely would have happened. Now, dial back slightly. Jackson died just before Gettysburg. We died after Chancellorsville, but before Gettysburg. I do think Gettysburg would have turned out differently, which would have affected the war, which would have made the North that much sicker of killing and death and all the crap that was going on. and the chances of theirs of, you know, it really came down to Lincoln, because Lincoln wasn't going along with any of this let's stitch the Union back together nonsense, you know, whether it was in two separate countries or a single country. He wasn't going along with that. But the South had, you know, hope right till the end of a negotiated settlement, because at some point, then it becomes like Vietnam, right? You win by, or Washington, George Washington, you win by not losing. But they never could have won outright. Absolutely no way. They didn't have any. I mean, that wasn't even in the cards. Individual outcomes would have been different. I do think, well, you know, we could go for hours, as you know, just Gettysburg and what would have happened on day two if Jackson had been there, and it really would have been different. There would have been blitzkrieging going on straight through the city and out, and there would have been no Union on high ground. But okay, that's just my own opinion. But anyway, no, they did. The Confederacy did not have the wherewithal to win, but did have the wherewithal to, you know, just make it so awful that the North had to come to a negotiating table somewhere and/or vote Lincoln out of office.
All right. Well, thank you for handling that big curveball of probably one of the top three or four alternate history questions of if the South could have won the Civil War, Stonewall Jackson. But getting back,
you know, the one I get, so Scott, the one just before you go on, yep, but the question I always get every time I speak about Jackson or my book Rebel Yell, it's the Gettysburg question. It's the one question I always get. So, and it's a legitimate question, and you know, God, he made trouble. And when you think of what Jackson and Lee did to the North, I mean, they tied him in knots. But anyway, okay.
That does tie into the next thing, because one of the strands of your book on the final year is Grant and Lee, where you present Lee as a man dealing with frustration and failure and loss. And that becomes more apparent as the war goes on with his weaknesses as a general. And there's been a stronger revisionist account in recent years where they're questioning the myth of him as this great hero who should be among the annals of the great American generals, but he just was battling a losing battle. And then you mentioned that Ulysses S. Grant, who in the final year of the war, he fails in his prowess as a field commander, even though there's a big Grant renaissance now with the Ron Chernow biography and others. So,
right.
What's your take on Grant and Lee in the view of the final year of the war?
So I do think Lee was a great commander. I think that, you know, if you parse the career, and one of the things I try to do in my essay on Lee is to parse his career a little bit more closely. I mean, here's a guy who was he did spectacularly well in the Mexican War, but really just had a career as a lifer in the army. He didn't get promoted much. He was an engineer at these places working on, you know, revetments and forts in New York and in the Mississippi River. I mean, it really wasn't much of a career. Not only that, it wasn't nearly what, if you took Light Horse Harry Lee, not only was he a great hero, he was also a great failure and kind of a lout who fled the country. And so Lee won trying to emulate the father's success, right? And on the other hand, trying to erase the stain of his failure. He was a lifer. And not only that, but he, you know, it took him, 17 years to get promoted to captain or something. And then he on the verge of the Civil War, he got passed over for a brigadier general by Joseph E. Johnston. He didn't have a great career. It was a competent career, and he was well thought of, you know. And of course, he became superintendent of West Point, but that was an appointment that kind of dated from an association that went back to the Mexican War. His early war at places like Cheat Mountain, I mean, where he was a failure, straight out failure. And you know, all the nicknames, you know, Granny Lee and Evacuating Lee, and then at 7 days, or just before 7 days, King of Spades. I mean, all people thought he was a little too fussy for command, maybe, you know, not really the guy. And then of course you get to the 7 days, which is what made him famous. It was a disaster on every single level. It was the worst staff work of the war. You couldn't have done it worse, except there was one person in the world who did it worse, and his name was McClellan. And it was a total comedy of errors. Well, not much of a comedy with all that death. Nothing worked for the Confederacy. And yet McClellan was so incompetent and so fearful that you had Lee went driving the entire Union army across the York James Peninsula and into their, you know, virtually into the river where they cowered behind the, you know, the gunboats, the federal gunboats. This was a poor performance that made Lee famous. I think what happens with Lee, when you start to see him working with Jackson, you start to see a different guy. I mean, the great victories of Chancellorsville, and Fredericksburg didn't take much to win, but Chancellorsville was a great victory. Second Manassas was, I mean, there was some serious brilliance operating there. So what I focused on was, you know, I do think Lee was a brilliant commander. I do think that if you look at his career, it's really interesting. He felt frustrated and he never had a happy family life, and he didn't spend much time with his family over all those years. And then you get, you know, into the question of his own personal loss. And it's something I'd like to get into with later. I call the Lee paradox. And the Lee paradox is the more Lee wins, the more everything gets destroyed, right? So Lee is a vehicle of destruction of his own country, but not only his own country, he's a vehicle of his own destruction. And meaning he has all these three magnificent estates that came through his wife's family, who are, of course, through the Custis George Washington connection. He loses them all. He loses everything he owns. He loses the slaves that he has. Right. He loses all of his money. His family is scattered. At one point, his kid is in a prison camp and his, you know, several members of his family are dying. The Christmas of 1864 in Richmond is just miserable and it's just awful, and they just lost everything. And this great weird irony of, you know, his magnificent mansion in Arlington being, he was filling it with the Union soldiers that he himself killed. But so the portrait I came up with was, and yes, I would challenge anybody who thinks he's not a military genius. But anyway, at the end, this is a guy has lost everything. And he's about to lose the whole enchilada when he has to surrender. But it's a really interesting, and so I think there's a good deal more depth to him. I think there was a sense that, in particularly the lost cause kind of sense, that he was the marble man, the perfect cadet, the guy with the great record, right? You know, he was just the perfect guy, the genius commander, superintendent of West Point. The Union had offered him command of all the armies and all this on and on, and how absolutely brilliant and flawless the guy was. Just no, that's not true. And so my account is complete revisionism from the lost cause version of him. On the other hand, I'm not knocking him down. I'm not saying, oh, well, yeah, but Lee was really no good. I would never say that. I think Lee was really something. But anyway, that's now we've gone on long. I've gone on too long about Lee. Now I can go on some about Grant. Of course, Grant, the last year of the war is set up by this great, I begin my book with, you know, Grant comes to Washington in March of 1864, and the great mythic invincible guy from the West, right, victor of Shiloh and Fort Donelson and Chattanooga and Vicksburg, and he's coming east now to take on Lee. Lee has just run circles around really the Union armies, and while he lost technically Gettysburg, Meade didn't pursue him, so that didn't really look like much of a loss. It looked like just kind of a tactical setback. But anyway, now so you have Grant coming east to take the commission, you know, as lieutenant general, and now it's going to be Grant versus Lee, and it's almost thought of as single combat. It's really not single combat. There's a couple hundred thousand soldiers involved, but it's this great moment, you know, where here we go. And both sides, I mean, particularly the Union, I think, thought this is it. We're going to win now. And then, of course, what happens to the glorious and fantastic and absolutely brilliant Grant is he basically gets his ass handed to him. Wilderness is a worse setback, except for the fact that Grant didn't see it that way. You could argue that it was a worse setback than Chancellorsville. The only difference is, instead of fleeing, Grant very famously marched by his left and continued on into Virginia. But so you have this, and not only that, but there are three other campaigns in Virginia. You know, there's one in the Valley, there's one in Western Virginia, there's the Butler campaign and the Army of the James. They're all disasters. So all Grant's great plan, the great genius, he comes and we have this horrible high casualty stalemate, virtually Wilderness, Spotsylvania, Cold Harbor, down to Petersburg, where everything just stops in the armed trenches, right? And this is in June of 1864. And so he's saying, how brilliant does Grant look here? How brilliant is this guy? How brilliant is he considering what he just did? And of course, this is the time of the greatest gloom and despondency in the North. They wonder, this means Lincoln is going to lose the election. But what I argue with Grant, though, it's sort of like Lee, but actually that moment of stalemate in the armored wastelands at Petersburg in June, let's say June and July of 1864, is when Grant actually seizes control of the war in a way that it's never been done before. He outflanks finally the War Department. He neutralizes them. He allies himself with Lincoln in this spectacular alliance between them. He completely seizes control to the extent that his camp at City Point, which is down near Petersburg on the river, his camp at City Point becomes the center of the military universe. Everything's coming in and out of City Point. His messages are going out. He's making these alliances. He's holding Lee in place while he's moving against Lee on all these other fronts, this time successfully. It's quite, I won't go into all the details, but it's quite brilliant, and it's the most brilliant, and what Grant did was the most brilliant thing about Grant, and he did it while sitting at City Point, ostensibly mired in this complete standoff in the trenches of Petersburg and Richmond. So, you know, I guess I see it more complexly than other people. Grant to me is a towering genius, and that was the proof of it.
Well, one factor too, and just to give a very brief summary of Civil War historiography to listeners who don't know about it, after the Civil War, many of the histories were written by Confederate generals and others that produced the Lost Cause myth that the Confederacy had more brilliant commanders and the North essentially won due to superior resources, even though Grant was a butcher and a drunkard and Lee was a genius, as you described. Now there's been pushback against this for the last, I don't know how long, several years. One book that's an example of this is Edward Bonnekemper's Grant and Lee, Victorious American and Vanquished Virginian, which argues that Grant overall was a much better strategist and could see the different factors of the total of waging a total war that allowed him to win. Whereas Lee, brilliant as he was on the battlefield, saw himself more as the leader of the Army of Northern Virginia and not harnessing all the resources of the Confederacy in concert, and thus couldn't win a total war. Where do you think you fall on the spectrum of these different sort of theses on the Civil War?
Well, to answer your first of all, to answer your question, Lee was not in command of any other any Confederate armies other than the Army of Northern Virginia. Mm-hmm. Grant eventually was. I think that's an unfair comparison. I know these people parse this six ways to Sunday, Lee never was. Right. Lee was never in command of any of those armies, Hood or Johnson or the armies in the West. I mean, never. He never had any control. Not only that, but Davis, who was a West Point graduate, of course, former Secretary of War, fancied himself very much a military guy and a tactician and a strategist. And Lee, it would have been far better for the Confederacy if Lee had been given command of all armies well earlier. And I think things would have gone much better for the Confederacy if that had been true. Davis was incompetent on many levels. The level on which he was most incompetent was dealing with his generals. And you see the feuds with Bragg and Johnston and people like that and Beauregard. They're just crippling. I mean, they're as bad as Stonewall Jackson's feuds with. I mean, it's just they're like crazy level feuds. But where I stand in the revision, Grant was portrayed for many years as a corrupt drunk. And the guy who was just, he was just throwing, blue-coated soldiers into the chopping machine to die, and he didn't really care. And because there were so many of them, and he would eventually win. And that was indeed this view. And we start to see that changing probably in the 70s or the 80s, I guess. And to me, the great revisionist change, at least in biography, was Gene Edward Smith's book, which I would recommend to anybody. It's a phenomenal work, and it kind of incorporates, I think it's around 2000, maybe late 90s, but it incorporates a lot of the kind of revisionist thinking that had gone on about Grant. Yeah, Grant has been totally rehabbed here. And Sherman has to an extent too. I mean, the Sherman, the absolutely evil Sherman who just burned the entire South for no particular reason, that Sherman has been rehabbed too, I think correctly. But yeah, I mean, Grant, well, I don't know. If you ask me, Grant was a great man. I mean, that's my feeling about it. I would be on the side of the Jean Edward Smith biography.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, you also mentioned Sherman, and something you state in the book is that he was a lousy general, but perhaps the most brilliant man in the war. Is that because of his march to the sea? Is that something else? What do you mean by that?
Okay, so as a general, when I say he's a lousy general, I have to kind of modify or explain that a little bit. He was a lousy general in terms of the way that we measure generals in the war. Let's say Stonewall Jackson, for example, or someone like George McClellan. The way you would normally measure them would be kind of battle performance, ability to handle troops in a battle in a successful way. Sherman's record is just flat abysmal. There's very little in it, in his war record. Let's say, if you look at Shiloh, he failed to see a 40,000 person Confederate army coming. It nearly cost the Union the battle. Now Grant also failed to see it coming, but there was his moment when he was in command in the West, when he literally had a complete nervous breakdown and went crazy. By his own admission, he became insane. Famously, all over the newspapers, he was seeing imaginary Confederate armies coming at him that weren't even there. And he was eventually kind of removed and put out somewhere where he couldn't do any harm by Halleck. Eventually, Grant rehabs him, and really his career in the war is because Grant likes him. And part of Grant's brilliance was to see how brilliant Sherman was, because he wasn't apparent. The Vicksburg campaign, he was the one weak point in it. He performed badly. One particular battle in a swamp north of the town, it was just, he lost a lot of men he shouldn't have lost. He was not present for any of the great victories. Chattanooga was the worst by far. Missionary Ridge, that was just an absolute disaster. I mean, you can really read anything. This is not me who's saying this. I mean, Sherman's failures of reconnaissance, failure to move, failure. He was supposed to be the man around whom that battle, Grant's famous victory, was built. In fact, he had virtually nothing to do with it, and it was a drag on it. Now, why does Sherman stay there then? Why does he get promoted? Because Grant thinks he's great. Grant's battle reports on Chattanooga are lies. Look, I'm an admirer of Grant. They're flat lies. he's covering for Sherman. Okay, so I don't think from if you got the like individual books about the Battle of Vicksburg, for example, or the Battle of Shiloh, or the battles of Chattanooga, there would be nothing here to contradict what I'm saying. I'm not like, this isn't just Sam Gwynne's wild theory about Sherman being not a very good field commander. Now, he would later prove to be an absolutely stunningly good administrator and a person in terms of moving an army and doing that kind of thing. He'd do that really well. But the fighting, no. So what was he brilliant at then? What he was brilliant at was basically seeing the war in a way that nobody else saw it. And the origins of that were in when he was made military governor of Memphis. First of all, this was after Shiloh. And then later in a march that he made across the state of Mississippi. And in Memphis, there was this problem of guerrillas that he was military governor up there. He had to deal with, you know, all this kind of irregular warfare around the town, and it just drove him crazy. And Confederate guerrilla groups were shooting at Union boats on the river, passenger and freight boats coming down the river, and so at some point Sherman just said, okay, every time y'all do that, I'm going to deport. You do that, I'm deporting 30 families. And they said, well, you can't deport. Where are we going to go? We're going to starve to death. People in the North said that too. Said, nope, deporting you. So, you know, the next time it happens, okay, the 10 leading citizens of the town are deported. And then there was this one particular case where, some sharpshooters were shooting at Union passenger ships. Sherman went and burned a town to the ground. He said, I don't really care. I'm not even going to look for who did this. I don't care. He said, you are collectively responsible for your own fate. This horrified people in the South, for sure. It was the origin of people not liking Sherman. Horrified people in the North. How can you do this to poor families? Sherman's point, they're all the enemy, and they are responsible collective for their actions. He then, the prototype for the March to the Sea was a march after Vicksburg. He got permission from Grant, and he took an army. They cut loose from their supplies, fanned out 20 miles, and marched straight across Mississippi, destroying everything everywhere they went. And it was absolute prototype. People were, how can you do this? These are ordinary people. You're destroying their crops and their fields, and you're destroying their means of livelihood. He said, no, you know, he, one of the things he said at some point was, I want to make individual ruin synonymous with the loss of the war. In other words, you yourself personally are going to be ruined. He then, of course, does this in Georgia, and then in a much worse way in South Carolina. I mean, they were kind to Georgia, actually, compared to what they did, because they were ordered not to do certain things in Georgia. When they got to the South Carolina border, South Carolina being the cradle of the Confederacy and where secession began, they got to that border, and then all of the barriers were taken away, or all the limits on them. And they just went and deliberately burned everything. They showed what a 60,000 man army could do if it really, really wanted to burn everything, which it did. So what Sherman emerges as is the apostle of the hard war. And he did. Oh, and by the way, his marches through Germany, Georgia and South Carolina, when he started them, he also did this astounding thing. He had this whole Confederate army commanded by, Hood, John Bell Hood, that was sitting right there and he was having his supply lines messed with Nathan Bedford Forrest. And it was all this mess. He just said, I don't care about them, Sherman said. I don't care about Hood's army. I really don't care about Nathan Bedford Forrest. I don't even care about the rail line from Chattanooga down to Atlanta. I just don't care about it. So he destroyed his rail line. He turned his back on all this. And he turned and he marched. And everybody thought this was insane, Grant included. Everyone thought, you're going to turn your back. You just beat this army in Atlanta and you're going to turn your back. You should go destroy it. You should pursue it till the end in the West. Grant said, no, I'm going to march across Georgia. I'm going to fan out, and I'm going to break the will of the Confederacy by showing them what is going to happen. But this is for which he's famous, of course, but the interesting thing about Sherman, and the most interesting thing, is how he felt compelled to explain what he was doing in moral terms to every single person he asked. If a little blue-haired old lady came up to him in the street and asked, he would stop and for 20 minutes lecture her on why this has to be done. He wrote long editorials. He spoke at great length for years as the kind of apologist and ideologue of this unbelievably harsh war. It was an anti-civilian war. It wasn't like what we did in World War II, which is to kill civilians. There were some civilian deaths. He wasn't killing civilians, but he was burning everything. He was destroying everything so they would starve to death, which is pretty close to it. But he became the theorist and ideologue of the hard war. And no one else was saying anything. The stuff, I go into this in my book, but a lot of the letters he wrote and published, things that he wrote for publication in newspapers explaining the moral position of the Union, how we, the Union, were the nicest, kindest people in the world. He said, all you got to do is stop fighting and we will give you everything. We will take care of you. You won't starve to death. This was the moral message. And nobody anywhere was saying anything like this. It was Sherman out there alone with his idea of how he was going to break the Confederacy and how he was going to explain it, particularly to the Confederacy, how he was going to explain to them why he was doing it to them. It's really fascinating. And the guy's kind of a verbal genius. And anyway, because the last year, and I'll wrap up this answer now, because the last year of the war is so bitter and it's so hard from the point of view of the South. The Shenandoah Valley gets burned. Large sections of, you know, Georgia and the Carolinas get burned. Well, South Carolina. You know, he is the embodiment of what happened to the war, which is a turn into a kind of bitterness that defines it, that defines the way the South felt about it anyway for the next, well, until now and continuing on to the future. And so for that reason, I guess he becomes sort of the poster boy of the book. And he's just a fascinatingly complex character, a racist. Some people did in the Union Army, but not on high ranking ones. And on the other hand, wildly popular with black people in the South, wildly popular. At some point, Stanton, the Secretary of War, comes south because they're so concerned about his public position toward slaves, freedmen in the South. They think he's a racist. They think he's awful. They think he's going to blow it for Lincoln. And so he comes down, makes a special trip, and he meets with all of these black leaders, all the existing black leaders within like a 100-mile radius, so the church leaders and any form of leader that there was. And at some point, he's meeting with them, and he calls them into a meeting. First time any black leaders had ever been called into a significant meeting about the Civil War. And at some point, he asks Sherman to leave. Sherman is just infuriated. And Sherman leaves, and Stanton asks the leader, says, okay, what do you think of this guy? They said, this is the greatest guy we've ever seen. This is a man given to us by God. We love him. He's a complex. That's what's so interesting about him. He's so complicated.
Well, this raised another question I was thinking of as you were describing that. Total war works sometimes, as in the case of Sherman, which you described. Other times it just makes people mad. So the times when it works is this, or you could look at something like Curtis LeMay, an Army Air Corps general in World War II, who engineers the firebombing of Tokyo. He supports the dropping of nuclear weapons on Tokyo. Other times, the population just gets angrier with total war. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, right. The Vietnam War. Right. You could argue British treatment of colonials during the Revolutionary War. So for another big tangential question, what do you think makes total war work, and what do you think makes it not work?
Well, first of all, we have to define our terms. There was the term total war, as it applied to the Civil War and in the Sherman lexicon, meant that you were going to go after civilian property. And just property in general. You were going to destroy all the cotton gins and factories, and then you were going to destroy, as Phil Sheridan did, every single, you know, by the time Sheridan got through with the Shenandoah Valley, there wasn't a chicken, an egg, a fence rail, a grain of wheat, a sheaf of wheat. There was nothing. He destroyed it. He didn't kill anybody, though. Okay, compare and contrast the firebombing of Dresden by the Allies, okay, with the dropping of the atomic bombs, with the firebombing of Tokyo. Those were attacks on human beings on a large scale. So total war, as we would understand it today, that would have involved, say, going to Atlanta and killing everyone. That didn't happen. So there is a difference in degree, and I guess the only time that I can think of in the Civil War when there was an anti-civilian attack was the Union shelling of Fredericksburg, which was really pretty radical, 100 shells a minute into a town, the only time they ever did that. But anyway, to get back to your point, it's a really good point, though, that when you take war to an extreme that it hadn't ever been taken to before, which is exactly what happened with Sherman in Mississippi and then Sheridan and, you know, Sherman again, when you take it to this extreme, I mean, you really make people bitterly and desperately mad. And so fast forward, we come to a very interesting, so, and then you see in the last year of the war, you see all kinds of pretty desperate, crazy guerrilla warfare going on all over the South, particularly in the border states. I mean, you know, completely irregular warfare, just killing and just bitterness and killing by people who were infuriated. And then you have this really interesting moment. I think it's Robert E. Lee's greatest moment, personally. The war is ending. The war is ending in the East anyway. I mean, Lee is cornered. Lee isn't going to escape. And he has a discussion with his staff, some very prominent and reasonable members of which are saying, you know, we should do what our president, Jefferson Davis, is saying we should do, is we should go to the hills. You know, don't surrender. We go to the hills. We fight on. He said, it'll be like trying to flush a covey of quail. They'll never catch us. So we can continue the war for years. And there were a lot of people who felt that way in the South. I mean, the president of the Confederacy felt that way. A lot of Lee's senior staffers felt that way. And it would have been probably the worst thing that could happen to the country. And it was the thing that Lincoln and Grant feared more than anything else, was that the war would never stop. It would be eternal guerrilla war. And Lee used his formidable influence and power right at that moment. And he said, we're not going to do that. We are not going to take to the hills. It's going to be too awful if we do it. And I think that, getting back to your point, I think the reason that was such a possibility, and all Lee had to say really was, yes, let's do it. And it would have been done. And talk about a bloody end to the war. It would have been really, I don't know. It would have been the thing that everybody feared, you know, about Japan and the rationale for dropping the bombs, which was you want to fight a 20-year war against tens of millions of people who are willing to die in a guerrilla warfare, a land war in Japan, or do you want to end this now? It was hypothetical, of course, but same idea. So in a sense, yes, it made people really mad and really desperate, and it was a really close call at the end whether they were going to the hills and just going to keep fighting. So, really interesting question.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Right. I mean, and it's very hard to answer because it's not just what Sherman was cooking up, but do you have somebody like Lee who will be magnanimous in defeat and call people to lay down arms and to rebuild? If you don't, then that makes things a lot harder. Well, another factor, too, I want to get to, and this is in the last year of the Civil War, something very important and should never be left out of this narrative are black soldiers participating in not only the Union effort, but calls for emancipation in the Confederacy. So I'd love to hear your take on this.
Well, you know, the war, the black soldiers, which amounted at one point to 10% of the Union Army, I mean, it wasn't just a theoretical kind of idea that they were tipping the balance of power. They did tip the balance of power. Because one of the things that, you know, when you look at Union supremacy in numbers, which is always, I mean, it always looks like it's 2-1, right? But actually, when you look at the amount of ground that the Union had to hold, the amount of railroad tracks it had to defend, just the amount of kind of guard duty and transport duty and defensive terrain duty and worrying about guerrillas duty, a lot of their troops were tied up. They were not able to be on the battlefield. And so adding 180,000 troops meant that, and a lot of them were in combat and a lot of them were also in support functions, but it really did, the actual available troops on the ground were often not that far apart between the two sides. And so it really did make a difference. And it was also, I mean, sociologically, it was what Lincoln correctly saw as the kind of, it was the mechanism of emancipation. I mean, you could say that somebody was free. Okay. And then somebody, then let's say a slave escapes, crosses through Union lines. Okay. He's free now. You know, is he really free? Well, we're still working on that one. But one of the ways to make emancipation real was for particularly not only freedmen, but slaves who made up more than 60% of the Union Army to become soldiers. Now they've got pay, albeit, you know, a fraction of the white soldiers' pay, but they've got uniforms and they've got purpose and they've got ranks and they've got, and they're soldiers. They're soldiers. That's who they are. They're not, what was your identity if you were like a slave who had just come through the line? Now you weren't anything yet. Maybe you were a tradesman or something, but you didn't have an identity. You were in some refugee camp. Well, as a soldier, it changed that. You fought for your country. Now they were horribly mistreated by the North, and they were targeted for, not only especially targeted for killing, you know, the Confederates shot at them if they had a choice, but they also were often given no quarter and they weren't taken captive in a lot of battles, and they were killed. It was very, very difficult for them, and I go into that in some detail in the book. But it was this phenomenal engine of actual emancipation. And you look at some of these black units and they're really interesting. I mean, I'm looking at one, I think was a Maryland, where they're all mustered in Maryland, I guess, but you had free carpenters from Maine and slaves from South Carolina, from Mississippi. And I go through the list of professions. There are like 20 different professions in there. And, you know, all this cultural exchange that goes on. The Northern blacks felt they were sort of intellectually superior to the Southern blacks, partly because they were more literate. On the other hand, they were more than happy to learn all these incredible songs that the Southerners learned over the campfires. Really interesting stuff. And some great battle tales also, which I go into in the book. It's a big part of my book, and it's a great tale of what happened in the final year of the war. Interestingly enough, the first infantry unit to go into Richmond after Richmond had fallen, the Confederate capital, were black. Against every single effort, I'll just tell this quick story real quick, every single effort of the white troops to make sure that didn't happen. So what happens is they get to this point, they crash through the uh, the trenches and the breastworks, which everybody thought were impenetrable, and there they are, and they're all kind of moving toward Richmond. They're only a few miles out, and everybody stops at some point or is ordered to stop, and then there's a decision made, and everybody knows what it's going to mean in life and history to be the first infantry into Richmond. Everybody knows what that's going to be. Nobody's under any illusions about that. And so it's decided, of course, that in their wisdom, the white officers decide they're going to let this particular white regiment be the first one. And they say, okay, and you black troops, you hold back here, and you can come later. Except that so the white guys take off. The blacks then immediately, as soon as they're out of sight, they look around, they take off through the fields, and they are moving. And they get there well, they get to the city well in advance of the white troops, which of course creates enormous animosity, and years and years and years of the white soldiers insisting that they were first and everything. But in fact, the black soldiers were the ones who were first. But anyway, to finish your question, right at the end of the war, it became really apparent to the South that, you know, there was always this kind of choice that, you know, there was this kind of choice toward the end of the war, I guess, that they didn't think they would ever have to make. And it was like between independence and slavery. It was not a choice that they would say, independence and slavery? No, we don't have to make that choice. We want to be the South free and have slavery. But as time went by, that became an ever more tenuous proposition. And on any number of levels. I mean, it was the, you know, as so many Confederate critics of the war pointed out, is you've given the North the moral raison d'etre. You've given them the moral reason to win the war. You've given the Europeans the moral reason to stay out of the war. You've done, just get rid of slavery and we can, and it'll be easier. Anyway, toward the end of the war, and so there was a whole movement in the Confederacy to do this. Part of this was a sense and something that they had 4 million slaves in the South, plenty to tip the balance of power, or to equal it out anyway. And so, you know, people had various theories about how to do this. You would, I think one of the strongest was probably that you would somehow impress the slaves from their owners, or they would volunteer them or something, and then you would offer them freedom in exchange for, you know, they become freedmen in exchange for fighting for the South, however it was going to be done. And that was when it was eventually done, that was how it was done. But it got to the point where it was very, very shrill debate going on in Richmond about this. And of course, people saying, this is crazy, it's the reason we fought, and now you're going to take this away. And it went back and forth and so forth. And then finally, Lee himself came out and said, no, we need to draft black soldiers. And you might imagine the outpouring of hatred against Lee in the South that came after that. But he was convinced of it. And this is right at the end. I mean, we're talking March of 1865. I mean, we only got a month to go before Appomattox. The Confederate Congress actually passed the law that said you could do that, and a couple of regiments were formed, and they were actually marched around the plaza in Richmond. People saw them, black soldiers in Confederate uniforms. I'm laughing, but it's sort of ridiculous on some level. But they did march, but it was too late. It was again, Richmond fell almost immediately, and there was never any large scale insertion of Confederate black troops into the war. There would have been had the war gone on for another year. And I think as much as anything else, it tied the Confederacy in these kind of moral, philosophical, religious, and practical knots they had real trouble dealing with. Because if the premise of your system is that there are these people who were somewhat less than human and we're kind of doing them a favor and this is the best system that they could have, and this is better than they'd be lost if they were on their own, because again, they're really not humans. And that argument falls apart very quickly if you're willing to make them soldiers. Anyway, it's a very interesting little subcategory of the war in that final year.
Right. I really got into this topic looking at the Civil War. From what I remember, the main proponents before Lee institutionalized it There was one general in particular, I forget his name, but he was from Ireland, and he didn't have as much invested in the Southern way of life and upholding slavery. So looking at it from a purely pragmatic standpoint, he thought, we have this vast pool of untapped manpower. Why on earth are we not utilizing it? But then it came to loggerheads with Southern ideology, like you described. Well, I'd like to bring this to the point of Appomattox Courthouse. And how do you see all these different strands of the Civil War in the final year coming together? And what do you hope is remembered from the Civil War that you think may have been forgotten that you would like to re-highlight with your book?
That's a tough question. I think what I, if the question is re-highlighting or, you know, bringing up something that kind of gets lost, I think certainly the black soldiers would be part of that, because people don't know that. I really don't think people know that. But I also think people who come from where I come from, which is the Northeast, my family, my wife's family, we're all from, you know, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York. I mean, we're all from that part of the world. And we didn't pay any price in terms of our property for the war. We, being the North, certainly paid a price in casualties and deaths. But we never had any particular sense of the destruction that was brought to the South. And I think particularly if you look at something like the Shenandoah Valley, and, you know, you can go there and it's the Yankees always wonder and say, well, boy, they're still fighting the war down there, aren't they? You know, well, I'm telling you, look at what happened to the Shenandoah Valley, one of the most beautiful parts of America. I mean, it was destroyed. It was taken apart. It was burned to the ground. There were some houses left standing, yes, but pretty much everything was burned to the ground. And so all these people there in the valley lost everything. They lost their sons. They lost their brothers. They lost their husbands. They lost their all of their money, all of their crops. They were sent to starvation. And so no one in Connecticut, where I grew up, had to do that. No one lost everything like that. And it was such a loss that you're looking at something it takes a century to dig out from. And I happen to be highlighting the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. Took maybe the worst of it in the war of anybody, because there's so much fighting. And, you know, when you have an army of 100,000, it pretty much cuts down all the trees for 50 miles. And, it's not a pretty scene, but certainly Carolina and Georgia. I think the harshness and the hardness of the war need to be reemphasized. I think maybe Southerners have more of a sense, people who've been generationally there have more of a sense of that. Northerners have absolutely no sense of it at all. I mean, you know, when I was in school, we didn't pay attention to the Civil War. It was a quick chapter, and we whipped them. Yeah, they fought for slavery, and because they liked slavery, and we whipped them, and then they spent the next 100 years trying to undo what we did. Period, and move on. That was it. And it's a very I've talked to a lot of other people who grew up, or at least in my generation, and maybe they do it differently now, but we never really had any sense of the war. What it did to people, how many people died, 750,000 people died. When you look at the amount of wealth that was wiped out in the Confederacy, the amount of farm machinery, the amount, you name it, just completely the industrial capacity destroyed. I think the level, I put a picture of the cover of my book of the destruction of Richmond, because I wanted to bring this home. It was a brutally destructive and desperate war, particularly in its final year. And I think that scarred the country and continues to scar the country in very palpable ways.
Well, there are definitely a lot of aspects of the Civil War and the legacy that many people say live on. And I think there's a lot of merit to that. So thank you for bringing all these stories to light. And if people want to check out more, your book is Hymns of the Republic, the story of the final year of the American Civil War. Sam, thank you for joining us.
Right. Well, it's been great talking to you, Scott. Really provocative question. Thank you.
Well, that's all I have for today. There's probably a million other things that could be said, but I think this is a good stopping point. First off, I want to give a shout out to the Spymasters for the Knowlton's Rangers. Vic Austin, Chris, Rob Matlock, Alan Baker, Beverly Ingle, Jake Harrington, Todd Warren, William Ivey, Joyce Norman, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Daniel Lawson, Marlene, Michael, Tim Clark, David Powell, Moondoggy from Ohio, Melissa, Chris Romain, Carl from Norway, and Baron Fraser. I'll explain what that is in a second. If you like the show and want to help it grow, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps spread the word about the show. Two, join our Facebook group. Here we can keep the discussion going about new episodes, and you can talk about what you like and didn't like. And you can find this group if you just search for History Unplugged on Facebook. Three, we have an online store with t-shirts, phone covers, and other accessories featuring awesomely bad history puns that were crowdsourced by you, the audience. And you can find that if you go to teepublic.com and look for History Unplugged, or you just go to historyonthenet.com and look for our store there. Four, and this is really the best way to dive deep with History Unplugged, and that's to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you know your American history, you know the Knowlton's Rangers were an elite spy and reconnaissance group in the American Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program of History Unplugged. You can join at three levels. If you join at the level of Scout, you can hear all the episodes of History Unplugged completely ad-free and get early access to new episodes, at least a week early. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get special bonus episodes, like a 10-part series on the World War II hero Audie Murphy, a multi-part series called Ottoman Lives about different people in the Ottoman Empire, and a series called Rendezvous with Death that looks at biographical profiles of Americans who went to fight in World War I before America entered the war. The last level is Spymaster, where you get all that stuff, but you also get three hardcover history books, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, Race to the Top of the World, Richard Byrd and the First Flight to the North Pole, and The Last Fighter Pilot, the true story of the final combat mission of World War II. Another bonus is, you can choose a history topic for me to focus on for an entire episode that can go up to an hour, and I'll answer whatever question you have for me, and you get a shout out at the end of each episode. If you want to learn how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, go to patreon.com/unplugged. That's patreon.com/unplugged. All right, well, that is all for my spiel. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast, from ancient Greece to the Cold War and everything else in between. See you next time.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.